thank you all for coming tonight. I like the musical accompaniment. It will add a light note to some of this heavy stuff. Oh, this is even better. Yes, it's that's good. To get into the framework of the arguments I'll be presenting tonight, I ask you to consider doing what Coleridge asked readers of fiction to do. Coleridge suggested that to experience a story or novel, readers should cultivate a willing suspension of disbelief. For the next hour, I would like you to cultivate a disbelief in regard to just two terms or categories. They are one, sex, and two, religion. Of course, I realize that there are some of you here who disbelieve in these things without any urging, and special greetings to you. Since its inception, feminist theory has produced myriad texts that interrogate the vocabularies and ideologies pertaining to sex. Disbelief in sex as an unconditioned, stable category that can at any time in any culture be convincingly separated from qualities adhering to terms like gender, nationality, welcome. Gender, nationality, race, and class is now a fundament of progressive thought, whether feminist or not. To understand gender as a historical category, writes Judith Butler, in a passage that exemplifies such a direction of theory, is to accept that gender, understood as one way of culturally configuring a body, is open to a continual remaking, and that anatomy and sex are not without cultural framing. Terms such as masculine and feminine are notoriously changeable. There are social histories for each term. Their meanings change radically depending upon geopolitical boundaries and cultural constraints on who is managing whom and for what purpose. Disbelief in the unchangeability of concepts related to sex and gender helped usher in decades of reform related to women's oppression. A key slogan during the period of feminist activism in the 1970s was "the personal is political," an axiom proclaiming that every facet of a woman's life is influenced by politics and thus nothing is off limits for political critique. Such an attitude opened up huge vistas for critical thought and progressive reform. Not only did such topics as domestic violence, sexual abuse, and wages for housework become subjects of study, but so did every idea, image, and representation having to do with women, femininity, and relationships between men and women become fair game for thorough scrutiny. The intellectual energy and activist spirit of feminist theory has been a significant influence on the development of theory throughout academia. Because entrenched and seemingly eternal concepts and behaviors related to man and woman, male and female, masculine and feminine, and girl and boy were discussed as contingent, mutable, and dependent on social and political factors, other categories thought to be universal, natural, timeless, and unchanging could be deconstructed as well. As was true of so much of the academy, feminist disbelief in categories of gender caught on in the academic area of religious studies with creative and productive effect. The subfield of women and religion gained traction and became an exciting place to be for theorists and activists. Meetings and conferences included a great diversity of specialties and viewpoints. For example, the challenging texts of Mary Daly, such as Beyond God the Father, were widely read and discussed. Likewise, the radical politics of Zsé Budapest, the Hungarian witch living in the U.S., were taken seriously. Both Daly and Budapest argued in different ways that religion supports male hegemony. If God is male, male is God, was one of Daly's oft-quoted and hotly debated lines. But gradually a shift happened. Instead of understanding themselves, ourselves, as thinkers on the boundary of established institutions, to use another phrase of Mary Daly's, Many feminist theorists in religious studies began to see themselves, ourselves, as representatives of traditions who speak from within those traditions. Groups, Catholic feminists, Jewish feminists, and feminists engaged in pastoral work, held separate meetings in addition to what became more ecumenical ones. At the gatherings that were meant to be more diverse, academics and activists attended as delegates of this or that religious perspective. Even the witches gained respectability as practitioners of a distinct and worthy religion. I realized that things had changed a great deal when one interreligious feminist conference had to be scheduled not to overlap with Halloween and thus cause offense. Of course, I recognize the work now being done in women and religion, which consists mainly of reforming religious traditions from within to be more positive toward women and a range of sexualities, is very important. And in all honesty, some of my best friends are engaged in such work as scholars, theologians, and clergy. Nevertheless, I think that women's rights and dignity throughout the globe will not be furthered and indeed are in danger of being eroded unless feminism turns some deconstructive attention onto the concept of religion. Now, one might think that interrogating the concept of religion might come fairly easy in a field like women and religion, in which sex and gender are disbelieved as a matter of course. Consider this quotation from the article on religion in the 1999 Encyclopedia of Women and World Religions. "Religion," writes Ursula King, a prominent feminist scholar of religious studies who I know taught in Britain for many years, "is fundamental to human experience, history, and culture, but is difficult to define. No single universally valid definition applicable across all cultures can be given, although many have been attempted." And Ursula King. And consider as well this passage written by two other well-known feminist academics in their introduction to a textbook titled Women and Religious Traditions. Pamela Dickey Young and Leona Anderson write, "It is not self-evident how religion ought to be defined because even the scholarly construction of specific religious traditions is a particularly westernized idea. Despite this," they continue, "there is much usefulness in examining religious traditions and how women are perceived and treated within the structure of those traditions." Both these texts, after nodding at the outset to the fact that religion is, to say the least, a very problematic category, nevertheless proceed as is usual in most all work in religious studies. They ignore the definitional conceptual conundrum and go on for sometimes hundreds of pages with statements about what religion is, what it does, and how it stands apart from things such as politics and secularity. I'm happy to report to you tonight that this refusal to think radically and critically is now being vigorously challenged. And I'm also happy to report that some of the most productive work on the topic is being done by scholars and theorists in the UK under the rubric of critical religion. And Andrew described the critical religion group, which I am very grateful to for their work. I've come over to be with them and to listen to what they've been doing. It's very exciting. So the Sterling Religious Group in Critical Religion questions the positioning of religion as an ahistorical thing or eternal part of the human condition that is asserted as having existed always and everywhere in one form or another. Instead, religion is seen as a rather incoherent and unstable category of political discourse whose strategic meanings have been myriad and fluid throughout European history. A category which, as Butler and as Butler said about gender, that quote that I just read, depends on a lot on who is managing whom in particular contexts. Some work in critical religion conceives of religion as an aspect of colonial ideology that is projected onto colonized groups and peoples who, when first encountered by colonizers, are described as not having any religion, and then are perceived as exhibiting one or even several crude and rudimentary religions that are inferior to the beliefs and practices of the Christian colonizers. Thus is the category of religion upheld as universal. Religions are claimed to be everywhere, and Christianity is asserted to be the best of the lot. World religions becomes a description of versions of Christianity. It is a term that designates others of the same. Because Western discourse is so powerful throughout the globe, the category of religion is adopted by formerly colonized peoples or so-called developing nations, who then describe themselves as having religion in order to conform to Western ideals. To illustrate that Christianity is the model to which behaviors and ways of thinking labeled as religious increasingly conform, I'll mention what I see happening in Judaism, my own so-called religious tradition, as an example. It is very common now to hear Judaism referred to as a faith. Many, if not most, contemporary Jews seem to agree with this. Faith used to be supremely unimportant in regard to Jewishness, a designation that had more to do with what could be called ethnicity and culture. Now, although descent is still of central significance pertaining to who counts as Jewish, there is among Jews greater and greater pressure to believe in something and to express Jewishness by participating in synagogues, which more and more resemble churches. Thus, are Jews becoming Christianized in order to be seen as having this thing called religion, a designation that carries currency in contemporary nation states and social contexts. Another example of religion as a stalking horse for Christianity is a popular tendency to describe Hinduism, which is itself a category originating from Western colonialism, as a monotheism. Polytheistic ways of thought and expression have been denigrated by theologians for two millennia. One result of this persistent bad press is a tendency to reduce rich cultural imaginings, such as those found in India, to a focus on one god, who unsurprisingly is male. Although the use of religion as a tool for the global replication of Christianity is undoubtedly important, it is not what I see as the main contribution of contemporary work in critical religion. That religion does not exist on Zeek, that is, in itself, as anything intrinsically separable from politics, culture, or what gets called secular, is what I see as the primary contention of critical religion that is key to understanding the functioning of contemporary states. Please consider this passage from recent work by Timothy Fitzgerald, right over here, a prolific theorist, a founding member of the Sterling Research Group, whose work continues to develop this growing body of theory. Fitzgerald writes, "I ask rhetorically, but with serious theoretical intent, why should the legal procedures and taboos surrounding our courts and ideals of justice, our separation of the branches of government, our concept of private property, the practices of the stock exchange and the capital markets, the traditions of the civil services, be considered non-religious? Why are transcendental values such as the belief in progress, or individualism, or nationalism, or the democratic virtues of freedom and equality, the practice of secret ballots and elections of governments, many of which millions of people died to establish and institutionalize, not included on books, in books on religion? Why should state institutions that defend the freedom of Americans, such as the Pentagon, the White House, and the Congress, be treated as non-religious rather than religious or ritual institutions? Is the Queen of England, who is supposedly head of a secular state, but who is also head of a national religion, to be treated as a religious or secular functionary? Is the raising and lowering of a national flag of religious or secular significance? Arguably, they are all both religious and secular, and in that sense neither, for they undercut this grand dichotomy. We need to dissolve these reified binaries if a new paradigm is to have a chance to get articulated in public discourse." I agree with Fitzgerald that binaries need to be dissolved to move us to a deeper and more progressive understanding of forces afoot in the world. In the language I've been using tonight, in special reference to feminist theory, I think we need to cultivate disbelief in binaries such as religion, politics, and religion secular. As a step in that direction, I propose that religions be thought of as forms of states, more specifically as vestigial states, that is, as governments that at one point in history exercise sovereign authority over particular human populations. When such vestigial governments are marginalized, either through war, invasion, or more peaceful processes of statecraft, they often live on within the newer sovereign state under the rubric of religion. I want to spend the rest of my time with you tonight trying to convince you of the value of such an idea. Since I'm arguing that religions should be thought of as vestigial states, a good place to begin is with an attempt to answer the question, what is a state? I'm going to list the six basic criteria of a state supplied by James Crawford in the second edition of his book, The Creation of States in International Law. Experts in international law assure me that Crawford's work, although not without its critics, is considered the benchmark of international legal theory about what constitutes a state. According to Crawford, a state is characterized by 1, defined territory, 2, permanent population, 3, government, 4, capacity to enter into relations with other states, 5, independence, and 6, sovereignty. In a general sense, although much can and has been said about these 6 criteria, they can be reduced to 2 broad attributes. 1, jurisdiction, regarding either space and or population, and 2, effective authority over such jurisdiction. I admit that before I started reading about these matters in international law, I did think the whole thing was much more complicated. I thought that a state was composed of perhaps more than jurisdiction plus effective authority. But this is not to say that there are not complications. For example, there is vital and significant discussion in international law about the putative existence of states in exile, such as Palestine and Tibet. And there are qualities attributed to the authority of a state that warrant special attention. One that Max Weber stressed nearly 100 years ago in Politics as a Vocation has particular relevance for my topic. We must say, writes Weber, that the state is the form of human community that successfully lays claim to the monopoly of legitimate physical violence within a particular territory. With both Crawford's and Weber's criteria for a state in mind, I ask you to consider the central linchpin of the theory I'm working on at present. Vestigial states, that I am saying formally known as religions, differ from the non-vestigial varieties chiefly in regard to the range of powers they wield in regard to the abstractions they cite to justify their authority. Those organizations recognized as states might ground themselves on such terms as freedom, equality, justice, or as the proper homelands of an idealized race or ethnicity. Whereas vestigial states called religions often appeal to some form of divinity, generally male, as a foundational principle. Interestingly, for the most part, the same abstractions are often cited by both states and vestigial states as bases of authority. For example, both the United States and Canada conjure God as an originary architect in patriotic pledges and preambles of their central documents. The references to deities as fantasized predecessors or designers of contemporary states add gravitas and justification to present bids for power and influence. Groups aspiring to have the status of religions often use narratives that identify with former sovereignties, both authentic and or semi-fictional. Contemporary forms of Wicca, for example, posit an ancient history in which governments were organized according to principles Wiccans now follow. Thus, Wiccans might be thought of as imagining their covens to be vestigial embodiments of previous sovereign governments. Putting aside the topic of new religious movements and returning to more mainstream phenomena, I want to suggest that Crawford's outline of what states do supports my argument, namely that those institutions called religions are usefully thought of in relation to statehood in terms of their histories, their foundational narratives involving territories and group allegiances, and in their managerial aspirations and procedures linked to regulation and law. Vestigial states that I want to identify as religions tend to behave as once and future states in regard to Crawford's criteria. They're somewhat restive and generally eager to take on whatever social, cultural, or administrative functions the more dominant state cedes to them. Presently, in contemporary states, categories of custom and law pertaining to family are considered proper spheres for religious authority. In contrast, violence in most forms is claimed as a prerogative of the fully functioning state, as Weber pointed out. However, I want to stress that forms of violence such as wife beating, disciplining children, marital rape, and male and female circumcision have not so consistently been treated as outside the purview of religion. States, fully functioning states, have been rather slow or at times completely absent in their efforts to curtail violence that can be considered to occur in the family, which is considered the province of religion. In general, whenever religions, that is vestigial states, claim rights to initiate or control police or military action, they risk being delegitimated in relation to the category of religion. Thus, in regard to Islam, for example, terms such as political Islam, radical Islam, or fundamentalist Islam are invented to cordon off state-approved forms of Islam from those that contemporary governments consider inappropriate. Islam is in the process of being turned into a religion, that is, of being made vestigial, within some states at the same time that it functions non-vestigially in others. Debates about the composition of proper forms of Islam illustrate how religion as a discursive category can be employed as a means of control in Western democracies. I suggest that vestigial states called religions begin to evolve when self-governing groups, whether ancient or modern, cede sovereignty along with the capacity to commit violence to other groups. Most of the time, this happens when a group is conquered, either by invasion or colonization. If the vanquished group survives at all, it is denied independent control over most governmental functions and must accept limitations on its powers and jurisdiction. And here I want to inject a note of humility to temper what might sound like a grandiose theory of everything. I understand that if the term vestigial state has any resonance, that it will be as a temporary, partial, and provisional tool for building theory. I hope that scholars who specialize in particular histories in geographical regions will test out the concept in reference to their areas of expertise to evaluate its use in a variety of contexts. Today, I will suggest three examples in which I see the concept as applicable and illuminating. The hypothesis that religions ought to be thought of as vestigial states works well when applied to Jewish history in a manner consistent with the work of Daniel Boyarin and Seth Schwartz. Boyarin argues that Judaism as a religion is created over the centuries in dialogues with Christian theologians. I contend that such discursive production is secondary to the machinations of state powers that had to deal with Jews as a conquered ethnic group within their jurisdictions. Schwartz's descriptions of the functioning of early synagogues reveal them to be governmental institutions in which local oligarchies designated by imperial states, that is the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, exercised an inseparable melange of civic, legal, and so-called religious powers. His general notion that the Jewish village evolves as a religious community in reference to successive colonizing empires supports my argument that religions arise as ways of granting attenuated powers to displaced governments. Texts, buildings, and assorted paraphernalia we now think as distinct artifacts of Jewish religion once served in the mechanisms of day-to-day processes of governing. For example, in the first century, writes Schwartz, in Imperialism in Jewish Society, it would not be an exaggeration to say that the Torah was the constitution of the Jews in Palestine, in large part due to Roman support and enforcement. I suggest that the evidence he discusses throughout his book shows that the governing roles allowed to Jewish leaders under imperial domination were not functionally separated into religious and non-religious spheres, but rather were inextricably implicated in one another. Over a long and complicated history, powers of Jewish community leaders coalesce under the rubric of religion, the only institutional venue which allows for the existence of a state within a state. The most famous utterance pertaining to Jews as constituting a vestigial state is, I think, in Matthew 22:21, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." According to this direction of theory, that statement, which has often been cited in support of a division between church and state, is read as a piece of strategic advice for a vestigial state. Give them the stuff they really want, and they will let us have some things that we want. A second example of the process of the formation of vestigial states in the direction of religions is, I think, depicted in ancient Greek texts, such as Hesiod's Theogony, and Aeschylus's Eumenides. In the former, the at one time fearsome Uranos is portrayed as a beneficent and harmlessly remote counselor after he is conquered by the Titans. In the latter text, Athena disempowers the Furies by assigning them a limited jurisdiction below the earth. She sweetens their displacement by guaranteeing them certain honors and recognition in the new governmental order. In both these texts, although the term religion is somewhat anachronistic, the succession of sovereignties is nevertheless marked by relegating former ruling orders to the status of what could be called a vestigial state, what is eventually called a religion as the term takes on traction through history. It is possible that the presence of a cult at any point in history is a remnant of a previous governmental structure. A third and fascinating example of the process I'm describing is happening right before our eyes as we speak. I refer to the recent canny and highly strategic move by Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama. On August 8, 2011, Lobsang Sangye was sworn in as the first democratically elected Kalon Tripa, or Prime Minister, of the Central Tibetan Administration in Dharamsala. At the swearing-in ceremony, the Dalai Lama expressed his satisfaction at having made good on his intention, announced several months previously, to separate his religious functions from those of an elected political leader. This is in keeping with the trend everywhere around the world to move toward democracy, he explains. By divesting himself of what he terms the political leadership that he says he inherited at the age of 16, he says he is conferring power on the Tibetan people, who he describes as the masters of Tibet, and not, that is, instead of, the religious heads or their heirs. "I always state," he maintains, "that it is wrong for religious leaders to hold political positions. I will continue to strongly speak about the importance of the separation of religion and politics." By restricting the functions of his office through clarifying, that is, classifying them as religious, the Dalai Lama is effectively limiting the powers of his successors. Thus, even if the Chinese government realizes its well-known plan to influence the selection of the next Dalai Lama by controlling the Panchen Lama, the authority connected with the now solely religious leader of Tibet will have been appreciably diminished. The Dalai Lama, as official head of a religion, will in theory at least administer and direct a version of Tibetan Buddhism that is no longer institutionally melded to Tibet as a state in exile. Contemporary Tibetan Buddhism is thus being fashioned into what I want to call a vestigial state, aka a religion, as a way of restricting the purview of Chinese domination. I might develop another historical example with a discussion of the Druids. beginning with a description given in Book 6 of Caesar's Gallic War. Caesar describes the Druids as central leaders of their government, deciding all disputes, public and private. He does say they control what he calls religion, much of it involving sacrifices. But this religion is synonymous with the state, just as it has been argued was true of religion in Greece and Rome. The term religion. Druids then evolve into practitioners of religion as the area of their jurisdiction shrinks to islands like Iona. They finally lose all sovereign power, are restricted to doing only what a succession of conquering Roman rulers allow, and only recently, in certain contemporary states, England and Wales, for example, in 2010, become officially recognized as a religion by the, it's called the charitable
charity commissioners.
That's right, that decides what is a religion in terms of charity. Now, turning to another segment of my theme, I want to specify more clearly what I think this trajectory of theory has to offer feminism. The theory of vestigial states is relevant to issues pertaining to gender and sex because religion is posited as referencing previous, indeed sometimes ancient, male-dominated governments. Consequently, the term religion promotes nostalgia for and therefore contemporary support of male hegemony. I sometimes wonder whether the revival of goddess religions is strengthening patriarchy by providing further authorization for the category of religion. Such reveries lead me to hope for future feminist modes of expression and imagination that would no longer claim to be religions. Women's challenges to male dominance have only met with appreciable success in the last several decades in the context of modern forms of state sovereignty. The systems of law, behaviors, and ideologies that are championed by vestigial states, that is, religions, tend to be regressive in regard to women's rights, dignity, and social standing. Throughout most of history, governmental organizations have been posited on a myth of male superiority and privilege, a myth which is then made true by the political institutions men create and maintain. According to the argument I'm advancing, when governments are displaced, they persist within contemporary states as religions that preserve their patriarchal origins and character. Since women's gains are so new and without deep roots in culture and tradition, progress could prove to be ephemeral if earlier states known as religions are allowed too much authority over domains such as the family or the home. I'll cite two examples that I think provide support for this part of the theory. First, from the United States, citing the right to religious freedom, recently dropped out Republican candidate Rick Santorum proposed allowing states to limit women's access to contraception, a right won by means of hard-fought court decisions beginning in the late 1950s. Religious leaders such as New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan have vociferously endorsed Santorum's position. Such rhetoric has spawned some successful efforts to defund organizations such as Planned Parenthood that distribute contraceptives and also make cancer screening available to poor women. Unimpeded access to contraception, a relatively new privilege granted to women in the USA, is now being questioned and curtailed through the influence of religious institutions. Similarly, both Santorum and Mitt Romney, the front runner for the nomination, Republican nomination, object to the new U.S. health care laws, funding of legal abortions on the grounds that it could cause employers who contribute to employees' health care plans to compromise their religious beliefs. Several newly enacted state laws now restrict women's access to health care related to reproduction on religious grounds. And second, from Afghanistan, according to reports from the Guardian News Service, in March of this year, a statement issuing from the offices of the Karzai government asserts that women are subordinate to men, should not mix with men in work or education, and must always have a male guardian when they travel. Thus, from a religious perspective deemed Quranic, the authority of the very new Afghan constitution is undermined in its provisions that enshrine the equality of men and women, which, by the way, is something the U.S. Constitution does not do. So the new Afghan Constitution is actually way ahead of the U.S. Constitution, although it is being undermined in that provision of equality. Furthermore, in forms of violence against women that are Sharia compliant, these appear to be condoned by that statement. Such news supports the opinion of Fawzia Kofi, the brave woman campaigning to be Afghanistan's first female president, who says that David Cameron and Barack Obama are supporting the Karzai government in talks with people who want to bribe the Taliban by limiting women's freedom using religious justifications. In both of these examples, religion is invoked as a backward, primitive force to reinstate patriarchal power in contemporary states, the U.S. and Afghanistan, in which women have only recently achieved a modicum of rights and dignity. In an interesting book called Who Sings the Nation State, Judith Butler and Beatrice Spivak suggest that a goal of contemporary feminism could be to reinvent the state as an abstract structure with a persistent effort to keep it clean of nationalisms and fascisms. Perhaps thinking of religions as vestigial states could have a place in such an ambitious and worthwhile theoretical project. I like to think that the theory supplements, in maybe more concrete political terms, Luce Irigaray's poetic insight that the revival of religious feeling can be interpreted as the rampart man raises in defense of his very maleness. In the time remaining, I'll turn to a segment of this argument that relates to gender and law. I was prompted to apply vestigial state to law when I attended a session at the University of Ottawa Law School about the application of Muslim divorce law in Canada. The speaker presenting her paper was Pascal Fournier, professor of law known for her expertise in family law. Fournier stated that she was confused by what was said by Muslim women she interviewed for research on their turning to provincial courts instead of Sharia tribunals in matters of divorce. The women, she said, seemed to be flirting with God. Since in the interview she quoted there was not a single reference to God, I was puzzled by what Fournier could have meant. Her answer to a question I posed asking clarification didn't help my confusion. The only sense I could make of it was that Fournier thought of religious law as somehow of another higher order than the rather practical way her subjects were treating it. The thought crossed my mind that to her, religion and God were both synonymous and vague. My impression was furthered when I read a report by Marion Boyd, the former Attorney General of Ontario, about comparing provincial family law with Sharia tribunals. In the report to the Premier of Ontario, known as the Boyd Report, Marion Boyd wrote that she was eager to avoid walking into what she called a religious thicket in her discussion of the topic. I had no idea what a religious thicket could be and wondered whether it referred to some sort of impenetrable fog that for her surrounded the category of religion. I started to think that perhaps a demystification of the construction and functioning of law in religious traditions might be helpful here. I add the disclaimer that the concepts of religion and God are quite impenetrable and vague, and I do think reside in a foggy thicket in popular and theological discourse. The description of the thicket in the fog, or the fog around the thicket, is surely part of the work of critical religion. I thought that one of the things legal experts Fournier and Boyd did not perhaps realize was that both religious and so-called secular law were made of basically the same stuff. That is, both were systems of state regulation subject to historical, political, and cultural contingencies. In regard to my theory, religious law issued from vestigial sovereignties, whereas secular law was the product of more recent enactments in contemporary ones. In a paper I just finished preparing for the Journal of Feminist Studies in Religion, I looked at three instances in which there was an interplay between so-called religious and secular law about women's rights, and in which I think the concept of religion as a vestigial state could clarify what is going on and perhaps weigh in on the progressive side. I'll briefly review two or maybe all three of these cases now. The first case is an example of how civil and vestigial systems influence one another in regard to issues of gender justice. It pertains to the granting of a Jewish divorce, called a get, to Canadian Jewish women and involves two legislative actions by the federal government. In relation to Jewish divorce, women's inequality begins with the Bible. Deuteronomy 24:1 states, when a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanliness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. This verse is the foundation of contemporary rabbinic law concerning divorce. It establishes the male as the legal agent who bestows the bill of divorce, that is the get, on the woman. When she has a get, she is free to remarry and have children with a new husband. If she does not have a get, she cannot be legally Jewishly married, and any children that she might have with another man will be considered mamzerim, a term whose rough translation means bastards or outcasts for 10 generations. Mamzerim do not have the same status as non-mamzerim in Jewish law, and to put it mildly, the word connotes a far from salutary condition. Men who refuse to give a get to their wives are not similarly disadvantaged. They can have children with other women without passing on inferior status to these offspring, as long as the mothers of their children are single. Although rabbinic law has undergone some changes through the centuries, the unilateral power of Jewish men to grant the get remains in force throughout the globe and causes much misery among Jewish women who want to remarry and start new families, but whose estranged husbands remain vindictive and recalcitrant. In 1990, after years of work by Jewish activists, the Governor General of Canada proclaimed an amendment to federal divorce law stating that no spouse shall maintain barriers to the religious marriage of their spouse that is within said spouse's control. Thus, a party to a civil divorce can request the civil court to provide a provision for removal of all barriers to future marriages. Once the civil court does this, a judge can interrogate both parties about compliance. If one party has refused to comply, the civil divorce or certain concessions in it could be jeopardized. The wording of this amendment treads a thin line between interfering and not interfering with Jewish law. The civil courts are not exactly forcing a Jewish man to give his wife a get, but they are permitting judges to take his refusal to grant a get into consideration when considering the enforcement of provisions of the civil divorce. Some studies show that provision of the 1990 amendment has resulted in elimination of two-thirds of recalcitrant cases involving refusal of the get before they are even heard in court. The mere existence of the legislation appears to be an effective deterrent. In 2007, the Supreme Court of Canada went a bit further to protect Jewish women from vengeful spouses who drag their feet in the granting of a get. 7 out of 9 Supreme Court judges in the case of Brucker versus Markovitz ruled that if a man signs a contract that he will give a get and he then refuses, the woman can sue him for damages in a court of law. In this particular case, Jason Markovitz had delayed 15 years in granting a get to Stephanie Brucker, his former wife. By awarding damages to Brucker, the court established the precedent that a man's religious freedom, that is the freedom not to give a get, did not trump the pain and suffering that this freedom caused his wife. In fact, the decision was partially explained in reference to its removing barriers to a wife's religious freedom, to the freedom to marry within the Jewish tradition. The wording of the decision relates for the most part to contract law, but the result has been interpreted as having a significant impact upon the conduct of religious groups. Justice Rosalie Abella, writing for the majority, states that the enforceability of a promise by a husband to provide a get harmonizes with Canada's approach to religious freedom, to equality rights, to divorce and remarriage generally, and has been judicially recognized internationally. Justice Abella's remarks raised the topic of gender equality and revealed it to be one of the considerations that motivated the majority to favor Brucker in the case. Note, too, that Abella refers to an international context in regard to equality rights and issues of marriage and divorce in reference to religious matters. Detailed citings of international precedents are part of the formal decision. The heightened awareness of a global audience constituency and or neighborhood is typical of ways such cases are being discussed and debated by judges, lawyers, and interested publics. It is important to notice that laws of sovereign states in regard to the treatment of women in legal systems named religious are being evaluated and influenced by reference to the legislation and practices of other sovereign states. Thus it is that religious law is evolving within an increasingly international and so-called secular context. Since the 2007 decision, two trends relevant to other ethnic and legal contexts are especially noteworthy. First, Canadian legislation has excited interest from women's groups both within Canada and internationally. Members of the Coalition of Women for the Get report that they have been contacted by Muslim women who think the Jewish experience could establish a helpful precedent for Muslims who might petition a civil court in regard to matters of marriage and divorce. Inquiries from other countries focused on how Canadian Jewish women were able to work productively with civil legislators are coming to the fore. And second, supporters of rabbinic courts, both within and outside Canada, are not happy because they feel that Canadian courts are infringing upon matters that should be wholly within religious jurisdiction. Although many rabbis, activists, and Jewish scholars are working to change Jewish law to curtail the unilateral power that men wield in matters of divorce so that a Jewish solution can be found, to date not much has changed in this regard. But Canada's laws on the subject have the effect of pushing the rabbinate toward reform. The 1990 amendment and the 2007 decision show that if Jewish lawmakers do not stand up for women's rights, civil courts might do so with the result that rabbinical jurisdiction could be further diminished. I think this case illustrates how both systems of law, secular and religious, are not essentially different in regard to any particular quality that could be named sacred, profane, or spiritual. Each body of law is subject to change through similar processes of skillful lobbying, argument, and interpretation. To phrase the point according to the theory I'm pushing, both systems of law could be described as state laws. One is the law of a former ancient jurisdiction favoring male privilege. The other is a more recent one that is more equitable toward women. In regard to the get in Canada, the ancient system is being pressured toward reform, both from within Jewish community and from without, by fully functioning state law. In the second case that I'll mention, the outcome is somewhat reversed, although the interplay between the two systems of law is clearer. I refer to the judgment given to a Moroccan woman living in Germany as a non-citizen who petitioned a civil court in 2007 to accelerate her divorce because her husband was violent toward her. Police had been summoned to the home on more than one occasion, and the husband had recently threatened to kill her. The judge, Krista Datz Winter, refused the request, arguing that wife beating is commonplace in Morocco, and that verse 434 of the Quran grants men permission to beat their wives if women provoke them. According to Datz Winter, the Moroccan plaintiff's Western lifestyle was sufficient provocation to justify her husband's violence. The Boyd Report calls attention to an aspect of German law pertaining to non-citizens that applies in this case. In Germany, and similarly in France, judges are required to use the laws of non-citizens' countries of origin in deciding cases in which such residents are involved. Thus, Datz Winter had to draw on her understanding of Moroccan and Islamic law, a body of jurisprudence in which she was not expert, to make her decision. The judge cited Quran 434 to support her verdict. A popular English translation of the verse reads, "As to those women on whose part you fear disloyalty and ill conduct, admonish them first, next refuse to share their beds, and last spank them," maybe lightly. At the intersection of scripture and law, Quran 434 and violence against women, published in the Journal of Feminist Studies in Religion, Shannon Dunn and Rosemary Kellison explore the practices of various methods of Islamic hermeneutics in regard to this highly controversial verse. They point out that several contemporary strands of interpretation oppose even slight physical correction that is supported by previous textual scholars and jurists who reference the passage. Muslims, write Dunn and Kellison, make use of various sources, including scripture, tradition, and human reason, in arriving at and justifying moral and legal decisions. For example, the fact that the prophet never hit his wives when he found them disobedient helps support a thoroughly Islamic position that does not sanction violence against women. Interpretations of various passages in the Hadith support this progressive view. When judges in civil courts are obligated to make decisions regarding Islamic law, Dunn and Kellison argue that they need to be aware of important debates occurring within Muslim communities about the contested nature of domestic abuse in the Islamic tradition. Dunn and Kellison's article is part of the valuable discursive production that is now part of global discussions about the interplay of religious and secular law in regard to gender. Such comparative analysis would be facilitated if religion were conceived of as congruent with secularity in regard to law. Perhaps recognizing religions to be vestigial states in regard to the social mechanisms that influence law, whether classified as religious or secular, would facilitate such understanding. And then I think I have maybe another 5 minutes according to that. I want to, because I see that Sukhwant Dhaliwal is here, and I've spoken to her about this particular case in Ontario, so I want to just go over it. The evolution of both vestigial and fully functioning state law in regard to gender justice is further illustrated in what has come to be known as the Sharia law controversy in Ontario. Nearly every fact about this wide-ranging issue is contested. To begin, even the words Sharia law are subject to debate, since there is not an agreed-upon definition of the term. Sharia in Arabic has been translated as the path to the water. It can refer to either all of Islamic jurisprudence or to only certain parts of it. There are literally hundreds of different schools of interpretation. At particular times and in particular places, a distinction is made between law considered to be divine and law considered to be man-made. Islamic family law or Islamic personal law, sometimes called fiqh, is often considered separate from Sharia law. Some of the persons and groups involved in the Ontario case use this distinction and thus employ a less loaded term than Sharia in discussions and submissions. In 2003, Sayed Mumtaz Ali, a retired Muslim lawyer, formed what he called the Islamic Institute for Civil Justice with the purpose of setting up what he called a Sharia court to conduct arbitrations related to family law in Ontario. He sought publicity for this move and announced that all Muslims in Ontario would be required to use the Sharia court instead of civil courts if they were to be considered good Muslims. This and a number of his other statements proved to be highly inflammatory. Ali's plan to use what is known as FBA, faith-based arbitration, had grounding in civil law. The 1991 Arbitration Act in Ontario allowed religious groups to set up quasi-judicial panels to help arbitrate domestic disputes related to family law in a manner that had previously been used in commercial law to settle claims related to businesses. This was a way to unburden the courts to reach decisions more efficiently and to better satisfy contending parties besides saving both public and private money. Jewish, Christian, and Islamic and Ismaili Muslim groups had been conducting such arbitrations for years. Couples could choose to come to these tribunals that would render a decision enforceable by Ontario courts. A majority of Ontarians had no idea that such bodies existed at all until Ali announced his plan. At that point, a great uproar was heard in the land. Columnists and commentators, feminists and non-feminists, religious groups and anti-religious groups produced voluminous discourse. Dalton McGuinty, the premier of the province of Ontario, appointed Marion Boyd, a well-known feminist and member of the New Democratic Party, the most left-leaning political party in Canada, to study the matter and make a recommendation. The board report was highly controversial. Canadian lobby groups such as the influential National Association of Women and the Law denounced it in the media. An open letter signed by some of Canada's well-known proponents of women's rights urged the premier to forbid all religious arbitrations in the province. In response to this pressure, McGuinty announced that in Ontario there would be one law and only one law for all citizens. And in 2005, Bill 27 was passed to ostensibly ban any group from using faith-based arbitration. Many Ontarians cheered this apparent victory, both for women's rights and for a progressive secular legal system. Other Ontarians were outraged about the insult to Islam, the province's Muslims, and other religious groups who had used FBA productively. Some defendants of Canadian multiculturalism were and still are appalled. I consider the wide-ranging discussion fascinating, important, and largely salutary. The ferment continues to produce valuable source material for further inquiry and research. First, the Boyd Report itself is a nuanced, well-written document that can serve as a resource for ongoing discussions about law, gender, and religion, both nationally and internationally. Marion Boyd sets the issue of FBA in a wide international context and displays a broad knowledge of many different systems of both state and vestigial state law. Her major concern is the well-being of vulnerable women who turn to court systems because of marital breakdowns. Her support of FBA thus absolutely accords with the stated moral purpose of feminists who oppose her conclusion. Both she and her critics want to protect women with limited influence and power. Boyd felt that Ontario's sanction of FBAs would place the tribunals under state scrutiny that would render them less detrimental to women's interests. Others felt that provincial approval would further empower oppressive legal systems. They feared that vulnerable women would think they were required to be subjected to the more patriarchal jurisprudence of the FBA tribunals without realizing that they could choose to turn to a supposedly more enlightened civil court. Second, because Muslim women's groups were split on provincial sanction of FBAs, position papers were produced that reveal Islamic law to be far from the monolith that many people claim it to be. I'm particularly impressed with a statement from the Canadian Council of Muslim Women in opposition to any official sanction of Islamic family law in Canada. And the following paragraph explains one of the many reasons for this opposition. The Muslim women are basically, they're afraid that Canada would set a potentially dangerous precedent, and all the reason, more reason to consider the matter seriously. They were against the imposing of the Muslim tribunals, although other Muslim groups were for it. I didn't read the whole quotation. I know that time is short, but it is an example of how discourse generated by the issue is permeated by awareness of global context and with a concern for women internationally. Another important result of the debate is that the province refused to sanction the law of any religion, mainly because of widespread concern for women's rights. Hopefully, this rejection of religion due to a moral concern might add more pressure to reform those vestigial state systems known as religion in the direction of greater gender justice. Thank you. Thank you.